live can be from the studios of Radio Catskill here in Liberty, New York. This is certainly the local edition. And that must mean I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Coming up tonight on the local edition, we've got the latest on the fight over mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania. It appears to be between Pennsylvania Republicans and the Republican President of the United States. President Donald Trump wants to get rid of mail voting, even as Pennsylvania Republicans urge voters to use it. I talked to Carter Walker, VoteBeat PA, coming up in just a minute. And we're going to mark the last day of Hispanic Heritage Month with the latest in Patricio Rubio's special series of interviews. He'll be talking to Isabel Taft, immigration reporter for New York Focus. All of that coming up. But first, young Republican activists in New York State who have ties to top party leaders have been implicated in a texting scandal. Politico obtained text threads that had racist, anti-Semitic, and homophobic language. Party leaders who praised some of those activists, including Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, are now calling for them to resign. Emily Russell has the details.
The texts were sent over Telegram, an online messaging app. Politico obtained nearly 3,000 pages of texts from January until mid-August. They include jokes about gas chambers, affection for Hitler and the Nazis, and hundreds of slurs, including the N-word. One exchange was led by Peter Junta. He's the chief of staff for New York State Assemblyman Mike Riley of Staten Island. Junta is also the former president of the New York State Young Republicans Club. In June, he was running to chair the Young Republican National Federation. In one text thread reviewed by Politico, Junta said, quote, "Everyone that votes no is going to the gas chamber." Joe Maligno, who also has ties to the New York State Young Republicans, responded by saying, quote, "Gas chambers don't fit the Hitler aesthetic." Annie Kakady, New York's Young Republican National Committee member, chimed in and wrote, quote, "I'm ready to watch people burn now." Kakady declined to comment to Politico, while Maligno didn't respond to the outlet's request for comment. Bobby Walker was vice chair of the New York State Young Republicans at the time of the text and now leads the group. He used the homophobic F-word multiple times in chats. Junta and Walker both apologized for the comments. The two have ties to North Country Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. Stefanik endorsed Junta for the national leadership position earlier this year. She accepted an award from Walker and the New York State Young Republicans in August. At the time, she described both Walker and Junta as, quote, "the backbone of our party." In a statement to Politico, Stefanik senior advisor Alex DeGrasse said the congresswoman was, quote, "absolutely appalled by the alleged comments," which DeGrasse described as heinous, anti-Semitic, racist, and unacceptable. Stefanik and New York State Republican Senator Robert Ort have called for the members of the chat to resign. I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Big thanks to the New York Public News Network for that report and all the great reporting we're able to get from our statewide partners. Just 5 years ago, we would not have been able to air a story like that that really connects our region, our state, to the national headline news you may have heard during All Things Considered. And the only reason we're able to do that is because listeners like you support the station. So we're able to be a partner of, a member of the New York Public News Network. So thank you to all of our supporters. Please join them by donating during our fall fund drive at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. I'm Jason Dole. This is a local edition. We're live tonight, but I do have an interview that I recorded last week, and it's about President Trump wanting to get rid of mail voting, even as Pennsylvania Republicans are urging voters to use it. What does this mean for Pennsylvania voters? You know there's only one person to ask, Carter Walker of VoteBeat PA and Spotlight PA, who I did speak to last week.
Thanks for having me.
So this is actually something we've talked about before, which is, you know, mail voting in Pennsylvania. I thought this issue was pretty much resolved with, like, the last major election. Republicans were behind mail voting.
Yeah, you know, Republicans have had kind of a love-hate relationship with mail voting over the past couple of years. Of course, you know, the Republicans controlled the legislature in 2019 when they passed the no-excuse mail voting law that's, you know, been the subject of lawsuits and debates for the past couple of years. But after that, you know, when President Trump turned on mail voting during the 2020 election, many state Republicans followed suit. Some even tried to have the law that they had written struck down. But as you said, in the 2024 election, after I think seeing how well they did not fare in the 2022 midterms, they changed their tune a bit and embraced it. And many people think that was to their benefit and contributed to their win. We saw more Republicans. They were making up a greater percentage of the people voting by mail than in any other election prior.
I love that pretty early on in the article, you quote a video ad from the Republican State Leadership Committee that says, you know, quote, in 2024, we voted by mail and flipped Pennsylvania red. So they're kind of like saying that they're definitely crediting the mail voting as having a role that benefited their party. Is that a current video ad that they've put out?
That is. That's one that's been running right now in relation to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court retention races. So, yeah, it's part of their messaging strategy to say, hey, you know, this worked last year and we want to defeat these judges, so let's do it again.
So it's not even an ad specifically about that. They just mention the voting by mail while they're, you know, advocating in a specific race or races. And that just, again, just speaks to the functionality of mail voting and the service that it did for the Republican Party.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, they're not alone in that. You know, conservative activists, they promoting mail voting as part of this campaign to, you know, not retain the judges. I found it interesting that the state GOP's website, its section on voting, you know, it lists three methods of voting, ways to cast your ballot here in Pennsylvania. There's really only two, mail and in person. But if you go to a county elections office, I think, you know, we have this workaround type of early voting. That's not really early voting, where basically you fill out a mail-in ballot in person, and they promote the two options of mail voting, the one at the county elections office and traditionally, you know, through your mailbox ahead of the in-person option. So obviously, you know, the sentiment isn't just limited to that one pack. I think it's more widespread with Republicans in general.
So that brings us up to the current moment with President Donald Trump in the White House. He's not a fan of mail voting. Has he not been talking to Pennsylvania Republicans?
Well, I'm not sure if he's been talking to them, but he's obviously been talking to somebody that seems to have changed his opinion from last year, because even he, during the 2024 election, as well as his son, Donald Trump Jr., were promoting mail voting here in Pennsylvania, you know, telling folks, hey, go out, request your mail ballot, or however you want to vote, absentee, early, by mail, that's fine. So he was on board with it last year, but, you know, he has shifted back towards the other end of the spectrum, so to speak. Now, in August, he said that he had made some allusions that perhaps he was going to issue another executive order on voting and that would be targeting mail voting. But then that didn't happen, although he said he was going to, quote, lead a movement to get rid of mail ballots and, you know, trying to lead a movement among Republicans to push back against this. But you know, as we mentioned on our story, a lot of these ads that I mentioned specifically, they're stuff that's either running currently or ran after Trump made those statements. So, you know, the messaging between him and state Republicans is obviously not conforming.
So you checked in with the Pennsylvania Republican Party for this article, right?
That's right. Yeah, I spoke with James Markley. He's their communications director. And he told me that, you know, they do feel mail voting has its flaws, but that they primarily wanted voters to vote by any legal means necessary. They said, you know, if mail-in balloting is part of the process and voters can't make it to the polls on election day, then they should request a mail ballot. So, and that is kind of instructive or representative of the broader sentiment I heard among Republicans, Republican consultants and the like, who are basically saying, you know, yes, Republicans, we have a problem with mail voting. We don't think it's secure. If we could, in an ideal world, we would get rid of it. But, you know, we recognize that to win elections, we have to turn out as many voters as possible. And this is another tool in our toolbox to turn out voters.
All right. Well, let's just talk about, you know, big picture mail-in voting in Pennsylvania. But let's take it from, you know, what the Republicans are saying, or just admitting that they don't fully trust it. Is there any kind of objective security issue with mail voting in Pennsylvania that you've seen as an elections reporter in PA?
There have been some minor issues over the years. I mean, you always have the one-off person trying to go vote for their dead spouse or dead relative. There was an incident outside of Philadelphia where somebody had gotten a hold of several people's personal information, their driver's license numbers, and was able to cast mail ballots on their behalf. But those incidents are typically involve a very, very small amount of ballots that, to my knowledge, has not ever shifted the outcome of an election, other than a rare case in 1992 involving a previous version of mail voting that we had. And I think the reason is because there are systems on the back end of the mail-in voting process that most people don't see in Pennsylvania that prevent ballots from being cast by somebody who is not the person who requested it, or prevent people from casting more than one ballot.
Yeah, I got to say that answer to me seems to be very similar in structure to what we've talked about before about doubts about in-person voting and the counting of in-person ballots, too. It's that same sort of thing that, like, there are issues, but they are almost infinitesimal when compared to all of the votes that are cast. And there's actually infrastructures in place to kind of catch these things and correct them.
Yes, I'd done a story on this a couple of weeks ago using some data of charges of election crimes over the past, I believe it was a decade or more, and this would involve mail voting and in-person voting, but instances of voter fraud where somebody's casting a ballot that they should not be entitled to cast it was incredibly rare if you look at it in the context of the votes cast over that period of time. I believe we calculated out that you are more likely to win $1 million in the Powerball, which is like a 1 in 11 million chance, than a fraudulent ballot was to be cast.
It seems to me anecdotally that things are becoming a little straightforward and possibly a bit less litigious with the mail voting, but I could be wrong. Are you seeing anything to back up my anecdotal take there?
Yes, the litigation does finally seem to be running out of, you know, ways that this issue can be brought up in court. But I would say the number one piece of advice that election officials are always telling me to tell people, or I'm always hearing them say, is, as you know, the issues that we're always talking about with mail ballots are not the ballots themselves. It's the return envelope or the secrecy envelope that's inside the return envelope. And the advice that election officials always give is, no matter what's going on in the courts, date and sign your outer return envelope every single time. Don't skip it because you might have read one of my stories from a week ago saying that the court ruled X, Y, and Z. Fill out everything on the outer envelope. Make sure you put your ballot in a secrecy envelope, and then you shouldn't have any problems.
And, you know, the last thing on the mail voting, and just worth talking about because, again, these stories come up of discrepancies and it's part of the process of the election. But your most recent article in VoteBeat is about dozens of Pennsylvania voters getting duplicate mail ballots. So are these voters that requested a mail ballot for this election?
Yes, those are mail voters from this year. And what had happened is, still a little unclear. I should say this is about 68 voters of the almost 1 million that have requested a ballot across the state for this November. And what happened is unclear, but it seems like this what this might relate back to is a problem that we've talked about a lot, is how the software we use to manage our election system here is about 23 years old at this point. And when counties might be going in to try and fix an issue with a ballot, then perhaps they're accidentally issuing a second ballot for a person. Like if they send a person their original ballot, but in the envelope, they accidentally included a ballot for another township, which is important because we have local races this year, then they have to reissue that ballot. But maybe they didn't cancel the first ballot, and so now the person was sent two. But as I was saying, with there being backups and contingencies for this kind of thing built into the system. One of the things that we reported with that story is that even if a person was sent two ballots, it wouldn't necessarily mean they have the ability to vote twice, because once the county receives back a ballot from a voter, they scan it into their system. And if they were to try to scan in another ballot into the system, it would stop them and say, hey, this person can't be credited with another vote because they've already voted.
Just going back to what we were saying about controversies over voting and focus and attention on voting in Pennsylvania, is it possible that there's not as much of that this time around because there isn't like a presidential election in this very swingy of swing states?
Well, you might think that, but actually some of these local years, the rules can be a lot more important. You know, you often hear the lawyers when they're arguing these cases try and draw that line pretty firmly that, hey, this isn't just about the presidential and the Senate elections, because, you know, whether or not you count or don't count five mail ballots because they don't have a date on them really probably doesn't matter all that much in a presidential election. But when you're talking about school board, that could matter a lot. So, I wouldn't count out that there could be litigation after this election.
All right. Well, I'm glad I asked that, because that's good to hear that all of these processes and even the challenges to the processes are going to acknowledge that, you know, local elections are important, too. So thank you for challenging my assumptions. That's why we go to Carter Walker of Vote Beat PA and also writing for SpotlightPA.org. Carter Walker, thank you again for the work that you do and taking the time to explain it to us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And now, to wrap up this edition of the Local Edition, we have Patricio Rubio continuing our Hispanic Heritage Month interviews. And this time it's with Isabel Taft, immigration reporter for New York Focus, talking about immigrant experiences across New York and what it means to elevate Latino voices in journalism.
What I really tried to do in this moment where there's so much federal flux in immigration policies that's having really dramatic effects on people's lives, I'm really trying to understand, how are New York State agencies, elected officials responding? How are local officials in across the state responding? How are they interacting with, in some cases, actively supporting federal immigration authorities in this crackdown, this mass deportation campaign? And so to be a little more specific, a big theme so far has been looking at how local law enforcement is working with immigration authorities. In particular, I've worked with my colleague Julia Rock on how local sheriff's departments are working with ICE to hold ICE detainees in their jails, getting paid by the federal government to provide bed space to hold people who are not accused of any crime, just New Yorkers facing deportation proceedings. I've also looked at the state's efforts to resettle immigrants who came to New York City in the 2022 to 2024 period, migrant crisis, trying to understand how those efforts worked, didn't work. In many cases, people who came to the city and the state during that period are now being arrested, detained by ICE, and raises questions about how the state has protected or not protected folks in that situation. And then also looking at elected officials and potential policy changes that they could make around things like dignity not detention, which would prohibit local law enforcement from detaining people for ICE. So that would eliminate some of what we've seen with local jails. And then New York for All limiting law enforcement collaboration with immigration authorities, where especially parts of upstate New York, I'll hear anecdotes about someone getting pulled over by a sheriff's deputy or a police officer in their town, and then that officer calls ICE or Customs and Border Protection. So that's a broad overview of what we've been looking at so far.
Let's talk about that. We're talking during Hispanic Heritage Month. How do you see journalism playing a role in maybe amplifying Latino voices that might otherwise go unheard, especially those who are being detained and possibly deported?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the most important things that journalists should be doing in this moment, and that I've tried to do in this moment, just make contact with people who are being directly affected by these policies. And to your point, certainly that involved reaching out to people who are detained on behalf of ICE in the Broome County Jail. So working with some jail advocates there who had kind of information about people on the inside, then using messaging platforms to communicate with them, get on the phone with them, just hear directly from them. What's your story? What's it like to be detained in this jail right now? What are you expecting for your future? How has this affected your life? And I think that is really important just to tell the full story, because otherwise it's just the people who run the jail telling us what they say is happening inside the jail and why they're doing this. And it's not the full story. And also had spoken with a young man who has protected from deportation, and New Yorker, who was arrested in August and has been detained in Louisiana ever since, even though he has a form of legal status here. So I was able to speak with him from the detention center that he's in Louisiana. And so do feel like it's really important right now to make extra efforts to get in touch with people who are in these really situations where, like, by design, they're being kept out of the public eye. And that's very much the intention of detaining them.
Now, what my experience with the Latino community in doing coverage here, and I say at least for the Sullivan Catskills, it's been very hard to get up inside the community just because they're scared. I remember times when, let's say during the pandemic, when PPE wasn't given out to some of the farm workers or the factory workers that we have here at Sullivan Catskills. And a lot of times when we try to get interviews with them, with someone from the Latino community who's directly affected by the policies, they were very hesitant to talk to us just because they're just scared of being deported or being found out or even just targeted, even if they have legal status here. Have you found that in your reporting?
Yeah, I've found that to some degree. And with the reporting that I have done in county jails, it's been unsurprisingly some people that I'll reach out to. Maybe they want to talk to me, but they absolutely don't want their name used because of that fear that you just described. But then for other people, one person that I talked to in the Broome County Jail said, I don't think things can get any worse for me. I'm happy to have you publish my name because I want people to know what's happening to me. And I just hope that being public about this could do some good. So it's definitely been, in my experience so far, a mixed bag. And I just try to keep in mind, always make the ask, always respect and understand if people don't want to talk or don't want to talk with their name. And I should also add, I'm very new to this role and so don't have super comprehensive experience. And I'm sure if we had this conversation in 3 months or 6 months, I would have different examples, different answers.
Yeah. Let me ask, I should ask this in the beginning, but let me ask about your background. How'd you make your way to New York Focus?
Yeah, I most recently was covering national news at the New York Times as a reporting fellow and did a little bit of reporting on immigration there, particularly the aftermath of a massive workplace raid in Mississippi in 2019 during the first Trump administration. And I had actually lived in Mississippi and been a reporter there for 4 years. And so the experience of covering national news and getting some experience covering immigration made me feel like I wanted to continue covering this beat, but wanted to do it for a local audience because I just love local news and I love local accountability reporting and feel like there's so many stories that get missed if you're not approaching the work with a local mindset. And in Mississippi, a lot of the work that I did had to do with law enforcement intersecting with other kind of areas of life. So in particular, health and mental health. And so was interested in covering this beat in a state where it's tremendously important at huge immigrant communities, very much in conflict with the federal government, but then also a very politically, geographically, racially diverse state where in different parts of the state, the story of the Trump administration's immigration policies are going to look totally different. And I have some investigative reporting experience as well as news experience. So was excited to join a publication where there's an opportunity for a lot of different types of storytelling and stories.
Yeah. Has there, and since I know you're new and you have written a couple stories already, but has there been any story since you have your time there and you're focused that sort of maybe shifted your perspective on immigration or maybe reconfirmed your immigration experience while reporting in the state?
Oh, that's a great question. I think one story that I found maybe clarifying just in terms of thinking about the recent history of immigration in New York State had to do with the Migrant Relocation Assistance Program, which was roughly $30 million effort launched in 2023 to help families leave New York City shelters for other parts of the state. And what I found in that reporting was that under the second Trump administration, I think close to 20 families that participated in that program with lots of support from the state have now been impacted by arrests, detentions, in some cases, deportations by ICE. And I think for me, that really drove home in a place like New York, whatever the state has tried to do to, however imperfectly, to welcome immigrants, to support them, to integrate them into the community, all of that is potentially being undermined by policies at the federal level. And I think it's an important question in New York to think about for a state that says it welcomes immigrants. What does it actually look like in this moment to oppose really harsh immigration policies? What can the state actually do? And so working on that story for me, I think, solidified just like the importance of trying to ask that question and really dig into that, because I think that's a piece of the national story that's very specific to the state that we all live in.
Yeah. Now, in your reporting, what have you learned about the, now, when we talk about immigrants, obviously, and immigrants come in all shapes and sizes, all cultural backgrounds. It's not just Latino communities that are coming to this country. But right now, the focus in this, I feel I should say, is the focus of this administration is on the Latino community. What have you learned about yourself, about the Hispanic Latino community that sort of shapes New York's identity, that's just beyond the population number? Because obviously the Hispanic community is growing here. But what have you found in your reporting that sort of deep, that shows them as human beings and they're actual people who have these lives and living here?
Yeah, I think one thing that just stands out to me is just the tremendous diversity in every single possible way when you're talking about New York's Latino community. And just in the course of my reporting, I've had the opportunity to meet folks who came here from Venezuela 2 or 3 years ago, have met folks who have been advocates for the Puerto Rican community in Rochester historically. So just thinking about the Hispanic community in New York, it's not all immigrants. The immigrant community in New York is certainly not all Hispanic, not all Latino. And I think the presidential election in 2024, which was before I was a reporter for New York Focus, but that really illustrated just the political diversity within this community, that there were plenty of Latino New Yorkers who voted for President Trump and plenty of people who immigrated to the U.S. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, who did not see necessarily themselves in the wave of people who arrived in 2022, 2023, 2024. So I think I've just been struck by the incredible richness of culture and individual experiences, and really trying to make sure that I'm not making assumptions about what is the Latino experience or the Hispanic experience in New York, because it's so clear from even just a couple months of reporting, there obviously is not one. There are just hundreds of thousands.
As your time evolves there at New York Focus, how do you think immigration reporting will evolve over the years? And what role do you want to play in that sort of involvement and as it plays out?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I'm so new to it and I don't have a crystal ball. I'm a little hesitant to make predictions. But yeah, I really hope that our work helps people understand how local and state actors here in New York have shaped the experiences of immigrants in New York, but really how that in turn shapes everyone's lives here. That sounds really vague, but I think there's a lot of room to dig into just policies and politics that have anything to do with immigration. So one example is immigration services fraud. There's a huge amount of fraud targeting people who are facing deportation or have uncertain legal status in this country. And it's, what could the state be doing to address that? What is the state doing when it gets complaints about those kinds of things? Is there adequate staffing to investigate those complaints? So just, I'm not speaking about immigration reporting in general, but for us here at New York Focus, I think the priority is going to continue to be understanding how our state and local governments are doing their jobs.
Yeah. Isabel, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know about your reporting or any sort of upcoming stories that you are working on?
I would just say I welcome at this point all kinds of tips, ideas, observations, thoughts. We're going to keep covering local law enforcement and immigration collaboration really closely. But really interested to hear from listeners statewide about what, you know, you're seeing in your communities that we should be digging into. I'd love to hear from you anytime.
Absolutely. So again, thank you so much for joining us. We're talking to Isabel Taft, immigration reporter for New York Focus. Again, thank you so much for joining us on the program and letting us know about your reporting.
Yeah, thank you, Patricio. Thanks for having me.
Big thanks to Patricio Rubio for doing that interview and his entire series on Hispanic Heritage Month. If you missed any of those interviews, they're all up online. Go to WJFFradio.org and make your donation there as well. This has been The Local Edition. We got The Daily up next.